Hello, it's Kathy Love here. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. It's my pleasure to share up more private practice stories and wisdom in this, our third season. My guests are generous, creative, and honest. It has been such a joy to be able to hold these conversations and capture these moments for your listening pleasure. We're sure that you'll really enjoy these unplugged chats and these private practice heart-to-hearts. So settle in, let's get the conversation started. Hello and welcome to this episode. And I am absolutely delighted to be face-to-face, or in your case, ear-to-ear with Natasha Hawker, the CEO of Employee Matters. How are you, Natasha?
I'm really well, Kathy. Thrilled to be with you again.
And recovering from a bit of a cough and cold. So
I am, and not happy about getting sick. I don't do sick well.
No time for being unwell.
No time.
So you'll hear us both sipping on water as we manage our voices. So for those that have been listening in for a little while now to the podcast, they will be thinking, yeah, we heard Natasha, and that was that crazy episode on International Women's Day when Kathy and Natasha were on their soapboxes about women in business and women in life. So we thought we would sort of segue from that theme and have a quick chat about life as an entrepreneur. And Natasha, what's been going on in your business for the last year?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's always great time to reflect back in January. You know what your results are over the calendar year or the first part of the financial year. For us, the big win was we grew our revenues 34%, which was pretty exciting. Wow. And we grew our profit as well. And there were a couple of reasons for that. And I think one of the little messages that I'd love to send your listeners is one of the ways that we did that was that everybody sells in a business. And it's interesting, Kathy, and you and I have spoken about this offline before, but I have a fabulous bunch of HR professionals who are typically women with 25, 30 years experience, some of them 15 years experience. But for them, sales is literally a dirty word. And we needed to change that because I was becoming a blocker to growing our business because there are only so many hours in the day. And so what we did was we actually systemized our sales process so that it made it easier for everybody to have a discovery session, a plan session, and our clients love it because they feel like they're going through a process that's very considered and they get value out of it whether they use this or not. So they go away with learning and feeling great, and either it's the right time for them or not. And that's been a major mind shift change for our team, but it meant we were bringing on 5 new clients a week instead of 1 new client a week on average.
So is this an example of managing yourself out of parts of the business?
Yes. So I don't do any HR. I'm not on the tools anymore is probably the best way to say it. Yeah. I do loads of podcasts and webinars and speaking gigs, and get me talking at a high level, I'm absolutely fine. But the devil is in the detail in what we do, and that's what my team are infinitely better at than I am.
Yeah. With a lot of the conversations I have day in, day out, there is this dance. We call it the clinical management leadership split and how you actually allocate that time. And I often tell the story that I didn't make any sizable growth or profit, notable growth or profit in my business until I left the clinic floor and I stepped away from the toy box and started managing the business. And I didn't do it overnight. I just did 4 days and then 3 days and then 2 days and then 1 day. And to be told, I was still doing half a day or about 3 or 4 hours of clinical work a fortnight until the day I handed the keys over and left. And that was enough for me. But that incremental release of the tools was my biggest growth factor for sure.
Yeah. And look, managing a team is extremely time consuming. And the way we've structured our business now is I have a general manager who manages the team on a day-to-day basis because that team's now 12 people. And that takes a lot, you know, in terms of coaching and growth and, you know, making sure we're giving our team what they want and need from us. And so that's worked brilliantly because it's meant I've been able to step up into a bigger role, which is very much around being a brand ambassador to have those partnership conversations, the much more strategic conversations than, and, you know, the really to be focused on the business and where we're going and, you know, how we're going to get our exit price that we've, you know, nominated in 10 years' time.
Mm. So you've brought on new teammates as well?
Yes. So we've grown, I think we brought on 4 new people last year, and that's fabulous. I love when we bring on new team members, and we will definitely grow again this year. And obviously being HR or employee experts, we have a very rigid process and it's very structured mm-hmm. and it looks at lots of different facets of it because, you know, it's really important that people are bought into our mission, vision and core values and our culture of our business because otherwise it won't work and they won't be in the right place for them or for us.
And your vision, mission and values just triggered a memory. Your new website is magnificent.
Fantastic.
It's
thank you.
Rocketed to one of my, in my all-time favourites. So maybe, because that was an activity across last year, share up with us just really quickly the process of rebuilding and rewriting. I can't imagine that just was entered into lightly.
No, and I think we need to take a step back. So when I started the business, I distinctly remember sitting in our office or our study at home with my husband and working out what our core values were going to be and what our mission and vision was. And it was just us at that time. And it really was pulling it out of there of what we thought we wanted to be, how we wanted to be remembered, which I think is a great way of thinking about your core values. When you've left a client, how do you want to be remembered? And then we revised them probably 18 months in, 2 years in, because they didn't fit anymore. They weren't right. We'd grown up as a business. And then literally front end of last year, it was probably July last year, we sat in with an exec team and said, let's rewrite our values because where we're going now is very different again. And some of them stayed, but some of them changed. And so that was a great journey of getting everyone involved in the decision of, you know, how do we, what is our mission? What is our vision? And what are our core values? And then we needed to make sure that that stood out on the website. And guess what? One of the things we hadn't done is actually put them on the website. So that when we revised them, that was the first thing we wanted people to know us by understanding how we act and behave. And then trying to infuse that through all of our content and our interactions with our clients. And we have one of the ways we infuse that is we have a What Matters and Employee Matters report that our team fill out every week. And they talk about, because we run a virtual team, they talk about what they've been working on. But the big thing is what value did they live that week and give me an example of it because we want to keep reinforcing those values again. So one value for argument's sake is long-term partnerships. So how did you live that value of long-term partnerships, you know, through your behaviours with your clients?
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Oh, sending you a virtual hug. Now would be a really good time to shout out your website. So if anyone's listening and they want to pause and go and have a look, they will just see the wording that you've used and the layout and the flow. So shout out your website.
Yeah, so it's www.employeematters, all one word, all lowercase.com.au. And I would encourage all of you listeners to go and have a good look around because we have a lot of free tools and templates on that. So there's a checklist of I'm bringing on a new employee, what do I need to do? And there's a whole lot of videos and stuff like that as well on our newsletter. We send out what we used to call the tip of the week video, but we don't name them that anymore. But there are 1 or 2 minute snippet that I've recorded about, you know, how do I make sure I'm hiring the best employees or what are my sourcing channels or how do I have one of those difficult conversations? Just short snippets that, you know, people have got the time to digest in this very busy world we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there anything else? Oh, there's going to be loads, but anything else from 2017 that has just stood out as a business highlight?
Yeah, I think the big thing for me, and I cannot stress this enough, and the people that are working with you, Kathy, are already doing this, but education is absolutely key. So I started my education journey back in 2014, and I have spent a considerable amount of money ever since then on being coached and get enormous value. And one quick story I will share is I can remember meeting someone who was working with a business coach and they'd been with them for 3 years and I'm thinking, are you guys not getting it? Are you not very bright? You know, why would you be still working with a business coach after 3 years? But the reality is your business changes and evolves and if you're doing good stuff, it's not the same business year one, year two, year three, and you're in completely new fields, and you need to still have somebody who can stretch you, keep you accountable, and you know, take you to that next level. So that is the one thing. And my big thing for the year that I learned last year is negotiation skills. I read a fabulous book that I keep raving about.
You do keep raving about this book. We'll put it in the show notes. I haven't read it.
You must read it, Kathy. And it's called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. He's an ex-FBI negotiator out of US, you know, a very hardcore guy. But he's now translated that into business negotiation skills. Now, my view is that I am not very good at asking for my true value. And I think a lot of predominantly women, more so than men, are not very good at that either. Mm. And so what this book has given me is some fabulous little tools and tips that are helping me negotiate more effectively. So much so as I've listened to the podcast, I've read the book, and now I'm going to do some one-on-one training through Skype with them over the next 6 weeks, one-on-one coaching. Because for me, I'm looking at acquiring a business this year. I'm doing more in the mid-market. I need to make sure that I can negotiate the best deal possible for employee matters. And that's a skill I need to work on. So I think personal development and education, you may be great at being a speech pathologist or a physio or whatever your core skill is, but business is so much bigger than that, and that's one of the things I've learned. I need to broaden my skill set.
Oh, I'm going to wrap my greasy mitts on that and have a bit of a read, and I'll keep following your posts for the value that you're getting out of it. Sounds as though it's been very powerful for you.
It has.
Good share. So you've been recruiting and building team. The guys listening to this podcast, and certainly my business coaching clients, have also been recruiting like crazy. What's happening in the recruitment piece? What can you share up with us about how to do it, what to avoid, the practicalities of it?
I think the first thing I would share is that this, I've been recruiting for 24 years now. It is what we call the tightest applicant market I have ever seen. What that means is there is a significant shortage of quality applicants out there. What that means for you, though, as a business owner, is you are in a war for talent, and you are going to need to compete very effectively with your competitors to make sure that the best and the brightest come and work for you that are a cultural fit. The way that you do that is you need to have a very compelling, what we call EVP, employee value proposition. What that is just you guys simply sitting down, and I'd encourage everyone to do this, and write yourself a little list. What's in it for them when they work for you? So are you a family-friendly practice? Do you offer flexibility? Do you offer training subsidies? Do you offer great mentoring? Or are you someone who pays in the top 75th percentile? What are the gotchas for somebody to come and work with you? Because you need to be able to articulate that in an interview process. The second piece around this is, as I mentioned, it's a tight applicant market. So the days of throwing an ad in Seek and getting your dream candidate aren't there anymore. So what you need to do is what we talk about, there's the active market, which is where you've got candidates that are actively looking for jobs, and there's the passive market. The passive market are candidates where if you tap them on the shoulder and said, hey, would you like to have a coffee and chat about a job, they may be interested to come and work for you. You can do that through different sourcing channels. LinkedIn is probably your most effective. So I would be encouraging people to build what we call talent pools. So think of Google. Google have a queue kilometers long of people that want to work for them. And why is that? Because they're deemed to be a great employer. It's great experience. They pay well. They educate, and they're doing cutting edge stuff. So how can you make your practice the sort of place that people are banging on your door to say, Kathy, can I work for you? Because I hear you're a great boss and you're doing great cutting edge things, or whatever it may be. So I think, and you need to get good at doing interviews is the other thing. Business owners have generally never been taught how to interview, and we teach our clients how to interview more effectively, because often they make a whole lot of common mistakes. They talk too much. They don't listen. They don't probe. They're not prepared for their interview, and they don't do a bit, ask the same questions to every candidate, and they don't do what we call a behavioural, a cultural, and a technical interview. Yep. There are three styles of interviews. Yep. So they're the key things I would say around recruitment.
Yeah. I get asked about interviewing all the time. I've been asked about interviewing three times just today. And, you know, there is a tendency to recruit for technical skills or hard skills. And I think that comes from our personal comfort as clinicians, that we know about that and that we have an internal compass about what good therapy looks like. So we'll just stay in this safe game. And then they wonder why that new recruit perhaps falls over in the customer service side of things or in the documentation or organization side of things. Yeah. And it's because it hasn't been a 360 interview or there hasn't been a good onboarding process or road test, as we used to call it. So I would love you to do some development work with interviewing with my guys. Maybe that's something we can dream up over something in a long-stemmed glass next time we meet.
Yeah.
Because it is really nerve-wracking. I remember being terrified of interviewing in the early days, and I grew to love it, love it, love it, love it. Couldn't get enough of it. I just over-interviewed because I wanted practice. But it is quite nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and the first thing I would do is encourage your team or your listeners to log onto the website, because there's a downloadable free ebook called Winning the War for Talent, which lays out a whole lot of questions and the style of interview and how to structure an interview. So that's a great resource for them. I believe most business owners are never taught the skill, and when they learn, they often learn from someone who's not been taught either, and so there are some real issues and you get what you deserve. And what's not happening is people do, or what they're doing is they skim across the top. And candidates are wised up these days, Kathy. So, you know, they're Googling what questions they're going to get asked too. And what typically happens is there's no deep dive on the question. So a classic example is, tell me about a time when you dealt with a difficult client. What happened and what did you do? And you get them to take you to that specific person when they were having that difficult time with a client. And you go, what did you think? What did you do? What was the, what did you say? What did you feel? What was the outcome? Can you give me an example? Can you see how I'm drilling further and further down? And out of that pops all of these behaviors, positive or negative. And the theory behind behavioral interviewing is past behavior indicates future performance. So if I put that candidate in a situation with a difficult client again, most likely they're going to act the same way. So you want to know that and be able to explore those scenarios so that when you put them in those situations in your practice, you sort of got a good feel for what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And you can then go one step further and go, actually, we know we want to recruit for these behaviors, client-centric. Bias for action, customer service skills, whatever those behaviors are. And then you can design questions that will solicit those behaviors if that's what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back a couple of minutes to the headhunting scenario and the tapping on the shoulder scenario. I think that this is pretty much the way of the future, and I would like to leave readers with the idea that even if they've got someone in mind who is already employed somewhere else, you just never know what they're thinking and what they're thinking about doing next, and that it is okay to be what you might feel is a little cheeky and to sort of say, look, whenever, let's just stay in touch.
And you're absolutely nailing it there, Kathy. That's what's called building your talent pool. So if you know that there's a highly talented individual, reach out to them, grab a coffee with them, let them know, look, it may not be right for you to consider other options, but when it is, you know, keep in touch and develop a relationship with them, because guess what? Even if they don't end up coming with you, there's a saying, good people know good people. Mm-hmm. And their tribe may be people you want to hire anyway. And so on LinkedIn, you need a special tool to be able to do it. But the way we're doing a lot of our recruitment for our clients now is we have the ability to search for occupational therapists in Timbuktu. And all the occupational therapists in Timbuktu come up, and then we can send them a soft approach that sort of says, we've got this opportunity, would you be interested in a conversation? Either they are or they aren't. But we're finding we're having to recruit that way a lot more than the traditional, let's throw an ad in, seek and see what happens, because of the tight applicant market.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an Uber moment in recruitment by the sounds of things, that you can actually go in and almost interrupt people's comfort and complacency and, their current jobs by just seeding the idea that somebody wants me, somebody thinks I'm fabulous.
I'm the value. And don't forget, too, that just recruitment in terms of platforms are changing. So, you know, don't necessarily do it the tired old way. You might want to have a really bubbly receptionist. So guess what the first part of the recruitment process should be? Send us a video telling us why you would like to be the face of Kathy Love Consulting or whatever it may be. And then you get to see how they interact and their confidence levels and so on. And then you might decide, yes, they're what you want and you want to invite them in for an interview.
Oh, very exciting. Do you get the sense that recruitment is going to be looking very, very different in another year or two?
Massively.
Yeah.
The platforms that are around at the moment and just Gen-wise, they want to be hired in a different fashion. So I was talking to an organization in the US and they have the ability on a mobile phone app where they can record a video of themselves and upload it while they're on the train to apply for a job. So they want to be applying for jobs on the move, not like us where we went home at 9 o'clock at night and then typed out our CV and sent it off. So it is changing. But the ability with that too is there is the ability, for example, to put a questionnaire in there and every candidate answers the questionnaire and then the system or the tool sorts it and spits it out and says, here's the top three candidates that match your criteria.
Yeah.
So that saves you a lot of time.
Yeah. And it takes out some bias as well, conscious, unconscious bias, that it is literally a bit of a matchmaking process. Oh, how interesting. And I guess the current platforms that we instantly think of, they've been around for a long time with very little change. Change as in you've got to pay more to use them, but, very little choice and alternatives and all the rest of it. So could be looking quite different.
And I think the last point here is around candidate management. So you want that candidate, whether they accept your job or whether you take them on or not, to have had a brilliant candidate experience with you. I get really cross with employers that put an ad out and the candidates go to the effort of putting their CV together and their covering letter and they don't hear anything. Not good enough. You want to protect your brand because whilst they may not be the right candidate for you now, in 10 years they might be your dream candidate, and if they've had a bad experience, they won't consider you. So differentiate yourself from your competitors by keeping them informed. It's as simple as that. You know,
my mum would say it's good manners.
Exactly. Great manners. And make them feel wanted and that, you know, you care about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not just the people who apply who aren't long listed. It's those that make to the next list but then fall away and then the next list. And even if you're down to the last two, you still need to be really honest and genuine and say, guys, you just didn't make it this time, but please stay in touch. Or if you're interested in some other work or something else, just to keep them nearby and build good solid memories of their experience. Yeah, I agree. All righty. So we thought we would also share up and have a little bit of a chat about performance management and performance development. And in planning this podcast, you know, half an hour ago, we realized that we were using some different terminology ourselves around this. What's current thinking about performance management, performance development?
Yeah, so let's talk about performance management, or let's talk about performance development first.
Yeah.
So in the good old days, performance development, you had an annual review, usually twice a year. It was a very loaded, lengthy document that the managers hated filling out and delivering as much as the employee hated experiencing it. That has changed. And even at the big end of town, you know, the thought leaders around KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers and Accenture have actually thrown that system out, which is interesting. I think they may have gone a little bit too far. Those conversations, and I think you guys call them clinical.
Clinical supervision I hear about a lot, and it just sends a little shiver down my spine, which I'll explain in a tick. But that tends to be chatting about tricky kids, and I'm doing air quotes because as a business owner, there is so much to awesomeness and awesome service than being a really good clinician. That might be a little hard to hear from people. Hopefully we haven't lost any listeners, but I really like the idea of working with people and making them the best people possible, not just working with an occupational therapist and making them an even better OT. And I think business ticks and hums along when you really take a whole person 360 approach.
Mm. So I think that's a good point. So when we talk about performance development, what we recommend to our clients is they have two chats a year as the formal part of the process, and they get the employee to do a self-assessment first. And it's four simple questions. What did you do really well in the last 6 months? What areas do you need to improve? What training or development or coaching or mentoring do you need? And then where do you want to go over the next 12 months? Get them to have a thought through that, think through that. Then you think through that and then have a conversation about it. That doesn't stop you having those one-on-one meetings. And I have some fabulous questions I'd like to share with your listeners about how to have more impactful one-on-ones, which you can go to in a minute. Performance management is different. Performance management, when I use that term, is where you've got an employee that is either underperforming in terms of the delivery of their work, or there is a misconduct issue, as in they are behaving badly in the workplace, which might be turning up for late. It might be the way they're interacting with clients or colleagues. It may be bullying or sexual harassment. They're misconduct issues. That needs both those situations. We find typically most clients avoid having those difficult conversations. So I would encourage your business owners, if you're a business owner, you've got to get good at having those tough conversations. And there's some tools and templates that we advise our clients to use to help them structure and also document those conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very much the performance management side of it.
Mm, yeah. So often I hear those words getting muddled up, and I'm kind of, in favour of the development. It's just so much more optimistic and sunny. And I guess vocabulary is changing around this all of the time. What are your thoughts about in position descriptions when you might have KPIs and you might have some really tight requirements, deliverables on the role? What role should they play in those conversations twice yearly? And
I think with job descriptions is the first document, absolutely key, and everyone needs one. And I was shocked when I was on a webinar I was doing this morning with a whole lot of participants, and 78% of them didn't have current job descriptions for their team, which freaks me out for a whole lot of reasons we can go into later. But the second part of it is around what we call an accountability matrix. That's the bit people don't do, which says, for example, the best example of easy one here is, as a speech pathologist, how are your bookings looking? So are you 80% booked for the week? And then and that might be one of your measures of managing a client base. And then there might be some proactive things that we like to do, which we call surprise and delight our clients. So we want to make sure that we are on the front foot and that we're sending clients stuff that they weren't expecting, nor were they asking, but it's hugely valuable to them. And that may be another thing that somebody's accountable for you and your team. When your business strategy, your job description, your culture and those accountability pieces all line up, then you've got synergy, and then you're able to achieve that strategic goal. So I think that's all too often not done, and people resist it too because they have to be accountable when you start talking about that. And it's not the case that someone's going to be out the door if they're not meeting that, but it does indicate a training and development area and or an issue that something needs to be changed, because otherwise you are not going to achieve. You can, with all the will in the world, go, here's our strategy, but if you don't break it down, you're not going to get there.
And if, by way of example, that 80% billable hours isn't being met, if not, why not? And there's going to be factors outside of the clinician's control invariably
that
point to kind of other leaks and tweaks in the system as well. So, I think that there is room for those KPI type things to come into the performance development conversation as well. And I guess that's also also starting to round out the conversation that those performance development conversations aren't just about the clinical skill set. Yes, that's got to be in there, but how are you meeting your customer delight targets? How are you interacting and serving your teammates? How are you investing in yourself as a human? And there's so many other parts to it as well than just the hardcore clinical skills. But because that's an area of comfort for business owners, it makes complete sense that that's what the focus often is.
Yeah, and I would suggest you need to do it gradually. So you might only choose one or two KPIs for them to work on, and then you build it up over time. But, you know, it's all well and good to say, here's how we want you to be accountable, but you've got to feed it back in a loop to say, here's what's happened when we've started to do this. So that comes back to that communication piece. So one of the things I do, which I think works really well, the feedback I get from my team works really well, is every week I send out a Voxer that says, here's what we're doing at the moment, here's the results, and I'll call someone out that's done a great job. What's the core value they've lived? What have they done well? And what difference has that made to the business? Because at the end of the day, they all want a job. They all need a job. And if your business is not thriving, then they may not have one. So we've all got to pitch in and get involved and also build the business.
Agree. And for those who haven't come across the little purple app that is Voxer, V-O-X-E-R, It is pretty much the prime communication tool between Natasha and I. And think of it as a walkie-talkie that you literally hold the button and you talk and it goes straight to the app on Natasha's phone. And it doesn't run interference on email. It doesn't run interference on your voice messages. It's quick. You can add photos and links and all sorts things. It's very cool. I love it.
I love it. It's on the go. We run a virtual team, as I said, of 12. So it makes it very easy for us to communicate as a group and cross group. And just when I'm on the go to, you know, just push my finger and broadcast something to make it happen. Great.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Take us back to something you said earlier about sharing some questions that can power up the I don't want to call it clinical supervision session, the performance development session.
Yeah, I'll even go one step further and say these are great questions for that one-on-one meeting. So yeah. I would encourage them to be having one-on-ones. Now, I can't take the credit for all of these. Some of them are the wonderful Seth Godin's work. But mixed in are my questions. So what were you better at this week compared to last? Question one. What skill have you focused on developing this week? What can I do to support you to do your best work? What predictions have you made that have come to pass? How are you feeling this week? We need to talk about feelings more in the workplace. People have a life outside work and often that can be going pear-shaped and that will have an impact on your business. What were you, sorry, my slide just disappeared. Who have you helped, especially when there was no upside for you? Can you see how culturally that is going to have a major impact? What would you change about your role, my team, or the management, or the company? Give them the magic wand that lets them change everything because they've got good ideas there at the coalface. What are you working on? What were you working on last week? What are you focused on this week? And are there any blockers? And I think they are 10 very powerful questions to dramatically shift the quality of the conversation in your one-on-one.
Are they available on your website? It would be really good if I knew that and didn't have to ask.
No, and but I think I might put them up there.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. They're great. Love them. I'm trying to just trawl back through them. They sound wonderful. Okay, so there's lots to learn on the performance development, performance management kind of front. Why do you think it's changing shape a bit? You mentioned that the C-suite, the big end of town, has changed what they do. They might have gone too far. Why do you think it is in a dynamic state right now?
Yeah, I think we had a system that never really worked in performance management, and we just did it, and we did it because that's what we were told to do. And I think what there's been a fundamental shift towards more of that lag indicator, you know, how have you been working for the last 6 months, to more of a lead indicator, what are we doing this week? You know, even more so into stand-ups. I think stand-ups are a very powerful option. We're even bringing them in virtually for our team. So a stand-up, for your listeners that don't know, is a 10-minute where literally people do stand up, so it can't drag on as a meeting. What are you working on last week? What are you focused on today? Or what are you working on? What were you working on yesterday? What are you focused on today? What do you need help on? And you just run it around the room, and it just, it's accountability, because people have actually got a voice what they're working on. And it's also, it just gets action, and it starts to move the needle seriously around what you're trying to achieve.
It's very good practice for your team to be able to be short and sharp and succinct. And it eliminates waffle, because they run out of time. They get the time signal. That's it.
You literally put an alarm on, and you hold people. People then get trained. You know, they start to,
exactly
to
right.
short and sharp. But they're very powerful to achieve, you know, a lot in a very short amount of time. We're going to call ours 10 at 10.
Nice.
There'll be 10 people on the call at 10 a.m., and away they go.
Okay. That all sounds sounds good. Alrighty. So that's just ongoing changes in that sector. Yeah. And I guess any business owners listening will also be sensing that they've changed in their own businesses as well. And it, even if you've got a really little team or a really big team, managing your people is probably number one job. But there's also a whole lot of businesses, and I've had amazing conversations during the last few weeks about teams wanting to grow. And it comes back to the very first topic of recruitment, that everyone is struggling to get in front of their ideal new teammates. But the steps that sit before that are still really, really bewildering. And it comes back to the old chestnut of, how do I engage my team? How do I do it legally? How do I do it ethically? How do I do it in a way that works for everyone? And what is this bit about contracting? Why independent contracting? What's casual employee? What do you mean about loading? Or do I go permanent part-time and just pedal like or get out to fill their books? I don't even know where we start with this.
Why don't I tell you? I know where to start. This is where your listeners don't start to not like me, if they actually liked me up until this point, because what I'm going to share with them may mean that they have been doing something illegally for some time. So let me put a caveat on this. Every single case, and I'm not giving legal advice here, I am not a lawyer, but every single case needs to be assessed on its own merits. But let's talk about independent contractors. Most people typically put their first employee on as an independent contractor because their view was that that was low risk and quick and easy to get rid of them. And, you know, they invoice them, so it's a lot less hassle and all that sort of stuff. The situation is that ATO and Fair Work don't like independent contractors. ATO don't like them because they pay tax in arrears and that affects their cash flow. Simple as that. Fair Work don't like them because they believe that as an employee that you should have minimum entitlements that should be protected, and by going down that independent contracting route, they are not being protected. And the last part of that is they think you as the employer are trying to avoid paying minimum entitlements. Minimum entitlements are your annual leave, your long service leave potentially, and personal leave and so on. The situation is that the test for understanding whether someone is truly an independent contractor is multifaceted and complex. And there are too many of the questions, the test questions, to go through today. But to just give your listeners a feel for whether they may have an issue, it's, do they wear a uniform? Do they have a business card with your logo and your name on it? Do they use their equipment or your equipment? Do you direct them day to day in how they do their business, or do they just turn up and deliver it in whatever way they want? If they are turning up and delivering it whenever they way they want, and you're not directing them, you may have an independent contractor. But if you are saying, I need you here between 9 and 5 on these days, and here's how we deliver work at ABC organization, not go away, do that piece of work and just give me the outcome, you're going to be in slippery slide area. Well, that's not very sensible, is it? You're in muddy water, for want of another one. So what's the problem with this, or what's the risk to you? It is if it's found to be sham contracting, you risk a fine of up to $63,000 plus what I call the stingers, which means that if that independent contractor has worked for you for, say, 2 years, you may have to back pay entitlements, which means you are back paying 4 weeks annual leave times 2 years. And they may have said, oh, look, she probably would have had 5 days out of her 10 days personal leave. So now I've got to pay 10 days personal leave, and you need to have accrued long service leave for them. Regardless, even if they are an independent contractor, you should be paying super for them.
Yeah,
just as an aside there. So I always say that the hairs on my arms go on end when we talk about independent contractor, because it's such a high risk area, and I still see lots of businesses doing it. And my concern is that Fair Work, when it came out, were quite flexible at the beginning. It's 8 years in now, and they have lost their patience. And Natalie James is very aggressively, who's the Fair Work Ombudsman, going after business owners who she does not think are legally not doing the right thing. Mm. Casuals is much better. Casuals is a much more flexible arrangement.
Casual employees.
Mm-hmm. Casual employees means that generally it might be a 4-hour limit on how many hours minimum. So if you only need them for 3, you still got to pay them for 4. It depends on your award. So you need to check your award.
So that's like a shift. I describe that as a 4-hour shift.
Yes.
Yep.
And you have to pay them a loading of 25%, because your casual employee does not accrue annual leave, does not accrue personal leave, and if they don't work, they don't get paid, and they don't have protections under unfair dismissal legislation, which might be another time. So casual is a much more successful way of doing it, and then obviously permanent employees. But don't forget, there's permanent full-time, permanent part-time, permanent fixed term. A fixed term, say, for example, to your point when you said pedal really hard to make sure you've got income coming in, you might go, look, I think I can see we've got a busy period coming up, but I can't see anything beyond December. So maybe you put them on a permanent full-time contract, fixed term, which dies or expires on the 30th of December. No one has to resign. No one has to be terminated. The contract just ceases. Then at that point, you either let them go because that was the end of the peak workload, or you renegotiate again, either into another fixed term or another long term, open-ended rather.
Yeah. From our previous conversations and what you've just said, the casual employee is a much more successful alternative to the independent contractor. And I suspect that many independent contractors are in fact probably permanent part-time, but to potentially change them up to a casual employee is probably a smart move.
Yes. And it involves, and regardless, any of your listeners, whether they're an independent contractor, casual or permanent, they need to be on a contract, which we might be going to shortly. But you must have them on an employment contract. And sometimes I hear, we get this from band instructors at school. The school P&C are trying to manage these independent contractors who are band instructors. And they'll say, but the band instructor wants to be an independent contractor. And I go, but the band instructor isn't liable for a $63,000 fine. You are. So, you know, you need to negotiate that, and that can be done well with communication. And also some instruments are more attractive to banks, you know, when they're trying to go for a home loan. They're not interested so much in independent contractors because there's no guarantee of income.
Absolutely. So the casual employee could be the way to go, but it really needs conversation, and it's a classic example of you don't know what you don't know. And this isn't a moment that you do what your friend did down the road or what your colleague did interstate.
Or what an industry has done traditionally.
Yes, yeah.
The industry is the same. They use a lot of independent contractors, and I think there's a lot of sham contracting going on in that industry as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I guess if we kind of slide on into the – and actually the other thing I want to add to this is that this model of engaging your team doesn't just apply to the clinicians. It's also potentially your bookkeeper, or if you've got an allied health assistant or even a volunteer, that's a great example for contracts as well, and your admin team as well, that, you've got to look at everybody, not just the clinicians, and that they all need written contracts.
Absolutely, and which is a lovely segue. I think, you know, all too often what we found when we talk to business owners, as I say, where did you get your contract? And they go, I borrowed it from a mate. And contracts are legally binding, and it's a contractual breach if you're found to be breaching it. And legal documents are legal documents. And sometimes, you know, we all get a bit lost in legal mumbo jumbo, but you are saying that you are going to do that. I gave an example on the webinar this morning, a couple of years, gosh, when I first started my business, a client, prospective client came to me. They're a security firm, and what they did was, you know, had security guards, and they had a whole heap of casual employees because they were shifts, to your point, Kathy. But somebody in their wisdom had just crossed out permanent on the top of the permanent contract and given all the casual employees the permanent contract just with casual written on the heading. So all of the entitlements had been transferred across. They were looking to sell this business, and I said to them, I really hope somebody does their due diligence, because you have just potentially, and one, some of their employees have been with them 20 years. And the employee thought they were casual, but their contract actually said they were permanent, which means they had accrued 20 years of long service, 20 years of, you know, leave and so on. So get your employment contracts either written by an employment lawyer, not just a general solicitor, because
it's true.
Like saying getting a GP to do heart surgery. It's a very different thing. But what we did was we have our employment lawyers have written a contract for us that we use for our clients that makes it cost effective, because it costs you about $4,500 to go and get a bespoke legal agreement. Having said that, I still think there's value in that to protect you. And case law is changing all the time. So even if you haven't had your contracts updated or reviewed for 3 or 4 years, we recommend it's every 1 to 2 years.
Yep.
It protects your IP. It protects your client base. It makes your, it restricts what your employees can do after they've left you, which is what we call post-termination restraint. So they can't then just put a USB and steal your client list and then go and start up and contact
them. Now that is a whole nother podcast conversation.
Yes. And if you haven't got it in your contract, that's poor form. But you can't stop them.
Yep.
If you have a good contract, you can stop them. And even with that post-restraint clause, in the good old days, they were pretty useless. You put them in there and hope the employee did the right thing. Now the latest judgments are they are really upholding and protecting the investment us as business owners are putting into our IP and our clients and what people who've worked for us should and shouldn't be able to do after they've left.
Yeah, that's good to hear. From personal experience, by working with my lawyer at the time to work through and develop those contracts, I learned to understand it, which meant that I could manage Q&A better and I could interview to the document better as well. So if I'd have just whipped it through the photocopier with a bit of liquid paper, I would be none the wiser. But the conversation around developing it was absolutely critical.
Yeah. And you need to know what you're stating you're going to do. And what we've often done for clients is build a cheat sheet. So in layman's terms, what are we signing up for here? What does this mean? What does a, you know, moral integrity clause mean and all of that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, we have rolled through a whole lot of topics. We just steamroller through this stuff, Natasha. It's always so good to chat with you. So to kind of round this out, maybe give us a little bit of a summary about what you guys do and how you work with allied health professionals and, yeah, a bit of a throw to exactly what you're up to.
Yes. So essentially what we do is we help our clients achieve business success through their people. I'm a great believer in your employees are your greatest asset. They're also potentially your greatest liability. But they are a lever within your business. And if you build a hire great people, build a high performance team and exit non-performers, nothing can stop you. Your business will be a success, especially in businesses like yours where it's about that people interaction. It's about that clinic experience. It's about often what's a very intimate relationship, you know, because people are sharing problems and so on. So the way we help our clients, and we're doing a lot in this space, is one, in your particular area with your clients on this call, we help them get great contracts in place to protect them and their employees. We help them work out what modern awards they're under, which is usually they know, but they don't know what classification their employees are. They are two breaches of the Fair Work Act. Your employees must know what award they're under. There must be a copy in the office and they must know what classification they're under. The other thing is around policies. We have an online hire to fire toolkit, which gives you all the policies and procedures you need, tools and templates to run your business with great HR. So say, for example, you've got to have a performance management discussion. Here's your performance management guide or the how-to, and here's the document so that you document it correctly in case they bring an unfair dismissal case against you. And then often we have, we end up doing is we are on a retainer where we have a certain amount of hours. We call them employee expert retainers, which is where you've got your own HR employee expert and they come in and out of your business as and when you need them. So say, for example, George is not doing what George should do and you're feeling awkward and you know you've got to have one of those dreadful conversations, you can get one of our employee experts to come in and coach you to do it or sit in with you or do it for you. And so that's incredibly flexible and it gives you access to an employee expert as and when you need it. So it can really help your business.
Also good. You've forgotten to mention your fabulous book.
Oh, I did. So I wrote a book called Hopeless. I wrote a book called From Hire to Fire and Everything in Between, which is available at all good bookstores. Sells at Dimmicks for $24.95. You can buy it online in an ebook version for about $4.95. I think the first person after this podcast goes out, Kathy, to send you an email saying I want a copy of Natasha, I'll send out a signed copy to them for free. And the other product, which I forgot to mention, and this might be particularly of interest to businesses that are getting to the point where they're looking to exit or they want to consider exiting or buying a business, we've developed a tool called Employee Metrics, which assesses a business's HR levels of compliance, risk, and best practice. And it gives you a full audit of where you're doing really well and where you're not doing well and where you're exposed to risk, and it gives you recommendations on how to fix that.
Whoa, that sounds great. You'll have to show me under the hood of that one.
Yes, and we have a mini version which we use with a lot of our clients, like your listeners, which is a high-level review but gives some good information.
Excellent. So 2018 is looking pretty brilliant. You've got all your ducks lined up. You've got we both do similar business plans and have it very visual and plastered all over the wall. So I can't wait to have you back for a chat, perhaps later in the year.
Love to.
I would like to publicly thank you for the support you offer to my tribe and my clients. And well done. Lovely to catch up.
Fantastic. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I am really passionate. I think small business owners work harder than anyone else in this world. And unfortunately, the skill set you need is broad. And I just want to help business owners achieve great success through their people.
Yeah, agree. Snap. Alrighty, we'll have you back. See ya.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for investing your time right through to the end of this episode of Private Practice Secrets. If you're running a private practice and keen for more business confidence and management know-how, head on over to our website, nacre.com.au. I'll spell it, nacre.com.au. Over there, you'll find all sorts of business resources and inspiration, blogs, forms, web events, freebies, our virtual conference information, workshops, and more. And don't be shy. Take advantage of the free power call and book yourself into my diary for the chance to have a business chat and to pick my brains. I'm Kathy Love, Allied Health Business Coach, wishing you and your business a brilliant day.